Fucking Mental is rapidly becoming an occasional spin-off series to Walk a Mile in My Shoes, where I explore the shit show that is mental health services in the UK. In this episode, I'll be talking about the use of electroconvulsive therapy. Some of what I'm about to tell you is truly shocking. Pun only marginally intended. When I started writing this episode, yes, I write it, it's not just a bunch of random thoughts slung together, I thought talking about the issues around ECT would only take a couple of minutes. How very wrong I was. Out of control. Dishonest. Manipulative. All stereotypes are thrown with gay abandon at people lumbered with a personality disorder label. Insults, I would argue, that would be better directed towards the purveyors of pristine prejudice, the Royal College of Psychiatry. Excuse me. Before I go on, I know, and you know, and you know that I know, there are thousands of people, professionals, including psychiatrists, punters, including psychiatrists, doing all they can to support people with mental illness, mental health problems, mental health issues, mental maladies, whatever you'd like to call mental distress, in a far from perfect system. With that proviso out the way, I think it's fair to say, what the fuck are you doing? Oh, I should have warned you earlier. This episode of Walk a Mile in My Shoes contains NHS abbreviations that some listeners may find incredibly annoying. I'll do all I can to minimise that distress. In what's been a fascinating month for psychiatry, it's hard for me to consider where to start. I could do a blatant plug for an earlier Walk a Mile in My Shoes episode where I talk about the implementation of the upcoming categorisation system for people labelled with a personality disorder. The International Classification of Diseases 11, the ICD-11, will galvanise existing institutional prejudice, deny services to thousands and cost lives. That would be beneath me. That said, I've put links to it in the blurb. So, let's talk about electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT. Now, back in the day, psychiatrists, under the guise of therapy, thought it'd be a most splendid idea to cause seizures or comas using insulin overdoses in patients they'd diagnosed with schizophrenia. It may come as a surprise to you, but the grandiose claims they made about the success of this diabolical procedure turned out to be false. Now, most of us would have looked back at these times as the Dark Ages, the 1940s and 50s, and think, bloody hell, let's never go there again. However, there were some plucky, some may say sociopathic, individuals who embraced new technologies and an entirely new client group, declaring they could electrocute the depression out of their patients. And psychiatry has been doing so since 1939, with, let's say, sketchy results. Let's fast forward to today. How many people do you think are given ECT in England and Wales every year? Go on, have a guess. It's around 2,500, more than a third of which was administered without consent. Mainly to women, 67%, and mainly to those over 60, 58%. Well, I hear you mumble. If it's a treatment that's well monitored and it's proven to be effective, surely it's for their own good. They've only got their best interests at heart. Well, dear listener, this is where we enter into a world of what the fuckery of Alice in Wonderland proportions. Sit tight, this isn't pretty. In a meta-analysis, a study of studies of ECT versus sham ECT. Sorry, wait a minute. Sham ECT. I know. I had no idea it existed either. Okay, very briefly, with ECT, patients are knocked out with a general anaesthetic and zapped with 70 to 120 volts, resulting in around 800 milliamps of current passing through their brain. Those who receive sham ECT are just given the general anaesthetic and told they've been zapped. Ethical, eh? Anyway, Professor John Reed of the University of East London, from which I graduated in psychology roughly 1,000 years ago, give or take, in collaboration with Dr. Irving Kirsch of Harvard Medical School and Dr. Laura McGrath of the Open University, concluded. In conjunction with the high risk of brain damage from ECT, this absence of efficacy evidence means that the cost-benefit ratio is so appalling that there is no place for ECT in evidence-based medicine. The key phrase here is, there is no place for ECT in evidence-based medicine. He went on to say, this body of research is of the lowest quality of any I have seen in my 40-year career. In his review of this shonky science, where he found little evidence of the long-term benefits of ECT, he concluded, the failure to find any meaningful long-term benefits compared to placebo groups are particularly distressing. On the basis of the clinical trial data, ECT should not be used for depressed individuals. I'll repeat that because his findings are truly astonishing. The failure to find any meaningful long-term benefits compared to placebo groups are particularly distressing. On the basis of the clinical trial data, ECT should not be used for depressed individuals. Off the back of this, he became a joint signatory of a letter to Peter Wyman, chair of the Care Quality Commission, a year ago when he wrote, given the high risk of permanent memory loss and small mortality risk, the long-standing failure to determine whether or not ECT works means that its use should be immediately suspended until a series of well-designed, randomized, placebo-controlled studies have investigated whether there really are any significant benefits against which the proven significant risks can be weighed. Professor Richard Bentall of Sheffield University analysed this review and concluded, ECT is a classic failure of evidence-based medicine. So, what's changed? Well, ECT continues to be approved by the NHS as a treatment for depressive illness, schizophrenia, catatonia, and mania, where 18%, nearly one in five trusts, are non-compliant with legislation concerning second opinions, which is just what you want to hear when a third of people who receive ECT are being shocked without their consent. Only one health trust out of 37 who responded, 51 were contacted, when approached with a Freedom of Information request, could report on how many people received psychological therapies prior to ECT. This is particularly alarming since guidelines from the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, last updated in 2009, stated ECT should be used only to achieve rapid and short-term improvement of severe symptoms after an adequate trial of other treatment options have proven to be ineffective and or when the condition is considered to be potentially life-threatening. The big question is, have people received an adequate trial of other treatments? If trusts aren't telling us, or worse still, if they're not collecting that significant bit of information, we just don't know. So, in amongst this maelstrom of God knows what, it's important to ask, are people being given adequate information before they embark on their ECT journey? Are they told about the high likelihood of memory loss, both short and long term, a side effect that can have profound impacts on relationships, employment, life in general? Are they told the grandiose claims made about ECT are based on sketchy science? Are people told about any of the potential longer-term side effects as outlined on the Mind website? Apathy, loss of creativity, drive and energy, difficulty concentrating, loss of emotional responses, difficulty in learning new information. Are they informed that they should have had access to psychological therapies before ECT? In 2003, NICE warned that information given to patients undergoing ECT was inadequate and said a national evidence-based leaflet should be produced. According to a recent report in the Daily Mail, Yeah, I know, the Daily Mail. Nothing was done, despite this warning. Of the 36 out of the 51 health trusts who replied to a Daily Mail Freedom of Information request, more than half used information leaflets with seven or more inaccuracies. Seven or more inaccuracies, including claims they could correct brain function abnormalities. Add to that, about half of the leaflets don't mention patients' right to a legal advocate. This is someone to inform them of the rights and support them in legal hearings. Surely now is the time for that national, incredibly overdue, evidence-based leaflet. How can anyone hope to make an informed choice about their treatment if they're not given the information they need and deserve? Why continue? Are the folk in charge of the Royal College of Psychiatrists refugees from Milgram experiments in the 60s and 70s where they developed a taste for electrocution and just can't help themselves? Seriously though, do they believe their own press when they say ECT is a way of resetting brain pathways in ways yet to be explained? According to the Daily Mail, when they approached the Royal College of Psychiatrists for comment, they issued the following statement. Our guidance is evidence-based, information and developed with input from those who have received ECT. Is it though? If you go to the Royal College of Psychiatry information page on electroconvulsive therapy, they firmly set out their stall under the heading, What Can Happen If You Don't Have ECT? They say, you and your doctor will need to look at the risks of the side effects from the treatment with the risks for you of not having ECT. Not having the treatment may mean that you're more likely to have prolonged and disabling mental illness, serious physical illness and possibly death from not eating or drinking, an increased risk of death from suicide. ECT can work when other treatments have failed. Some patients have previously been successfully treated with ECT, have found it so helpful that they have asked to have ECT if they become ill again. A confident statement, I'm sure you'll agree. That is until you read their all-encompassing disclaimer. It reads, Disclaimer. This resource provides information, not advice. The content in this resource is provided for general information only. It is not intended to and does not amount to advice which you should rely on. It is not in any way an alternative to specific advice. You must therefore obtain the relevant professional or specialist advice before taking or refraining from any action based on the information in this resource. If you have any questions about any medical matter, you should consult your doctor or other professional healthcare provider without delay. If you think you are experiencing any medical condition, you should seek immediate medical attention from a doctor or other professional healthcare provider. Although we make reasonable efforts to compile accurate information in our resources and to update the information in our resources, we make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether express or implied, that the content in this resource is accurate, complete, or up to date. With a you can't sue us disclaimer of this magnitude, you have to ask yourself, why fucking bother with an information page at all? I wouldn't buy a used car from them, would you? I encourage you to take a look at the Royal College of Psychiatry information page on ECT. I might be being biased, prejudiced, but from what I've read, I don't think so. Listen to the different ways they speak about potential long-term effects of ECT. They say, with great conviction, rigorous scientific research has not found any evidence of physical brain damage to patients who have had ECT. Compare that when they seem reluctantly concede that some unscientific anecdotes by patients, not scientists or doctors, suggest there may be some problems. Some patients do say they have suffered brain damage and that they do have long-term side effects and that have changed their lives. Testimony from user groups and observational studies have suggested that after ECT, some people also experience a change in their personality, a loss of creativity, energy, and or drive, or lack of emotions. Remember what Professor John Reed said about their so-called rigorous scientific research. This body of research is of the lowest quality of any I have seen in my 40-year career. Together with the statement from Professor Richard Bentall that ECT is a classic failure of evidence-based medicine, it really makes you wonder about the seemingly grandiose claims on the Royal College of Psychiatry's information page. A page that makes no reference to patients' rights to a legal advocate, that is, someone to inform them of their rights and support them in legal hearings. I don't know what to make of it all. I don't understand psychiatry's desire to tenaciously cling to ECT, especially in the face of growing scientific evidence that questions its efficacy. I feel incredibly uncomfortable when they say it's used almost as a last resort, once other therapies and treatments have been tried and failed. I'm fairly sure I've mentioned this in earlier podcasts. After being on an NHS waiting list for 2 years for talking therapy with no end in sight, I can't call myself a service user because there are no fucking services. What other treatments have been tried? With only one out of 51 health trusts in England and Wales offering up any information about what's been tried previously on their ECT patients, where's the evidence? What excuse could they possibly have for not producing a national information leaflet for vulnerable people, their friends and families who are sitting on the threshold of ECT? 18 years after the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence highlighted the need for a national evidence-based information leaflet, there's still nothing. Is this a case of this is the way we've always done it, or professional ignorance, arrogance, or complacency? Are professionals so desperate when they're presented with a person in emotional distress, with the belief there really is no alternative, that they're willing to try anything? Is there such a dearth of talking therapies available that when some pills, don't appear to work, then they see ECT as the only option? Professor Reed raised his concerns that the majority of patients given ECT are women aged over 60, saying, "I think that this is probably because they are less likely to have anyone to speak up for them and question why it's being done when it provides no long-term benefit and involves real risks of memory loss." Dr. Reed and his co-signatories sent the letter to Peter Wyman, chair of the Care Quality Commission, a year ago, as it was the 59th anniversary of the death of Ernest Hemingway, the most famous of the millions of casualties of ECT since its invention in 1938. Hemingway took his own life after 20 ECT sessions, writing, "Well, what is the sense of ruining my head and erasing my memory, which is my capital, and putting me out of business? It was a brilliant cure, but we lost the patient." It has now been 60 years since this Nobel Prize winning author died. And what's changed? 2,500 folks still receiving a treatment that's based on sketchy science. There's anything between 800 and 1,250 folk who are being forced to have it without their consent. And there's still no sign of change. It's fucking mental. What can we do? Well, you can share this along with the links in the blurb with anyone you know who's about to undertake a course in ECT, their friends, their family, professionals with an open ear. At the very least, we should support Professor John Reed in his demands. Remember, he wrote, "Given the high risk of permanent memory loss and the small mortality risk, the long-standing failure to determine whether or not ECT works means that its use should be immediately suspended until a series of well-designed, randomized, placebo-controlled studies have investigated whether there really are any significant benefits against which the proven significant risks can be weighed. Speak to your GP, your MP, write to Matt Hancock, although I understand he might be a little busy just now. But let's make a noise about this. If you, a friend or family member, has been affected by ECT, please get in touch. It would be a privilege to share your story. Until the next time, thanks for being there. Walk a mile.